I'm Warren Smith, and today you'll be listening in on my conversation with President Emeritus of World Vision, Rich Stearns.
I go to work now and I think, hey, I'm Christ's ambassador in this place. I'm here to demonstrate the character of Christ, the love of Christ to the people around me. So now it's not about whether I'm going to get ahead or get a promotion. It's like, how can I be a good ambassador for Christ?
Rich Stearns believes that success is overrated. Now, that may sound strange coming from a guy who just wrote a book about leadership and from someone who's had a great deal of success in his own life. But Stearns believes that God requires of us not success, but faithfulness. He says that success as the world defines it, money, power, influence, profits, may or may not follow faithfulness, but that faithfulness must remain our goal even when it doesn't. Rich Stearns unpacks these ideas in his new book, Lead Like It Matters to God, Values-Driven Leadership in a Success-Driven World. After a successful career as president of two large secular organizations, Rich Stearns took over the reins at World Vision in 1998. Under his 21-year tenure as president there, World Vision became the largest Christian ministry in the world. Its annual revenue now exceeds $1.6 billion. The organization has had its share of controversies. Some evangelicals object to its partnership with government organizations, including the fact that it takes significant government grants. In 2014, World Vision had a controversy regarding same-sex marriage. Stearns said in an interview that World Vision would allow employees in same-sex relationships to remain with World Vision. However, the outcry from donors and others was so great that the board of World Vision just a few days later asked forgiveness, and the organization reaffirmed its commitment to what it called the biblical covenant of marriage between one man and one woman. That commitment to biblical marriage remains World Vision's position today. Rich Stearns spoke to me from his home in Seattle. I was in my home studio in Charlotte, North Carolina. Rich Stearns, welcome to the program. It's great to finally meet you. I've known about you for many, many years, but to be able to, even though we're not in the same place, to be able to see you and meet you is a real pleasure. So thanks for being on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Warren. I've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks now.
Well, yeah, me too. And in part because I, in preparation for this interview, I actually read your book and I really liked it. So that was a blessing for me because that is not always the case. In fact, it's especially not always the case with leadership books. You and I talked offline about the fact that I'd worked for a couple of leadership companies, probably spent 5 or 6 years with two different leadership companies earlier in my career, and had the same experience with leadership books that you confessed to really early in your book. And that confession is that you don't like leadership books too much.
Well, you know, I've always felt I didn't read a lot of leadership books coming up through the ranks, partly because they always made me feel a little bit insecure as a leader and not worthy, because most of them required us to master some new set of skills or some new leadership paradigm. And I always felt like, man, I guess I'm not a very good leader because I don't think I can master these these things that they're talking about. And so I don't have any issue with leadership books. It's just that I didn't spend a lot of time reading them. Also, I really believe that you have to lead your own way. You've got to know who you are as a person. And when you try to imitate somebody else's leadership, it often doesn't work very well, because every leader is different and every leader is going to have a different style, and that's okay. I mean, God made us all different. We can lead differently. There are some principles that I think are universal and very important in leadership, but we're all different.
Yeah, and I want to talk about some of those principles soon enough, but I wanted to talk a little bit before we got into the individual principles in the book about some big picture ideas. Number one, your own biography, your story that got you to the place where you wanted to write this book involved a lot of success in your life, especially early in your career. Well, not especially early, because you've had success throughout your career, but also some failures early in your career. Can you talk about those failures and kind of weave those into your biography a little bit, and why those failures were so vital to your development as a leader?
Yeah, you know, you've heard the phrase, never trust a leader without a limp. And what that means is, you know, if a leader hasn't hit some rough spots in their career that have been humbling, you know, they probably, you know, maybe are a little bit too full of themselves later in their career. But, you know, I've had a wonderful career and yet a crazy career. You know, early on, my first job out of business school was selling deodorant for Gillette. And then I did that for about 2 years, and then I went to Parker Brothers Games in Salem, Massachusetts for what I thought was a dream job. You know, I got paid to play board games. And I was at Parker Brothers for 9 years. The last two of those years, I was the CEO. So I kind of rose through the ranks and became a CEO at 33. And that leads up to my first failure story because, you know, when you're 33 and you're the CEO of a nationally known company, your sails are pretty filled with your own wind, you know, and you know, it was kind of a heady time for me as a leader. I, you know, and then very suddenly, after about 2 years in that job, I got fired. And yeah, I won't go into the whole story, but the company changed ownership and the new owners wanted different leadership. And so I found myself going from the corner office to a corner of my basement, you know, unshaven in my bathrobe, but looking for a job every day. And that was incredibly humbling. And I managed to find a job within a few months at the Franklin Mint down in Pennsylvania. I was excited. I moved my whole family to Pennsylvania, started a new job, and 9 months later got fired again. And so my wife said to me, I don't know what lesson God is trying to teach you, but whatever it is, I hope you learn it quick.
Right.
And then I spent the next 9 months unemployed and looking for a job. And losing a job is incredibly devastating for almost everybody. I mean, you get so much of your identity from your work and what you do and who you do it with. And of course, it's mortifying to be fired because, you know, people think, well, what was wrong with you? Or and you might start thinking, well, what is wrong with me? You know, why did I get fired? But those things, Warren, were the real blessings in my life because that was the time God put me on the bench and needed to talk to me about, you know, my priorities.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you to maybe dive into that era in your life just a little bit more, maybe not a lot more because we don't have an unlimited amount of time. But that 9 months on the bench, even though you'd been a Christian for years by now, you talk about that in your book as a time of real growth in your life. Can you talk about that a little bit more and explain why you think that that was necessary in your life and what you learned as a result?
Well, I think it gets to the core of why was I doing what I was doing? In other words, I was a Christian. I'd go to work every day, but my career was kind of all about me. You know, it's like what I could achieve, you know, where I could excel, you know, the raises I could get, the promotions, you know, I had not really deeply reflected on how God wants to repurpose us in our lives. He wants us to integrate our faith with our work, and he wants us to surrender our work and our careers and our lives to him so that everything we do is for his glory. There's a line in my book where I say, we must surrender our ambitions for Christ's ambitions for us. And that was the understanding I came to during these times of unemployment where I had very long quiet times with the Lord and a lot of time in scripture. And I realized that my job on earth as a follower of Christ was to love, serve, and obey God. Whatever circumstance I was in, if I was unemployed, I could love, serve, and obey God. If I was the CEO of Parker Brothers, I could love, serve, and obey God. It didn't depend on my circumstances. And so when I finally got my next job at Lennox, the fine china maker, president of a small division, I was so excited to be back at work and having another opportunity. The Lord gave me another opportunity. But I started every day with this prayer. I said, Lord, you know, you did not call me here to sell more dishes and fine china. you called me here to love, serve, and obey you. Show me today how I can be that servant in this place today. That's my goal.
Well, that's a very powerful word, a very, very powerful testimony. You know, a couple of ideas started jumping out to me from your book right about this time as you were sort of unfolding that story and that part of your biography in the book. One of those is this idea of a secular model versus a biblical model of leadership. And you talk about the importance on a biblical model of leadership of being faithful rather than successful, that the secular model of leadership really wants us to be successful. And they really don't care how we get there, right? But yeah. The biblical model of leadership, the definition of success is different. It's faithfulness. Can you say a little more about that?
One of the metaphors I like to use is that of a GPS or Google Maps. And when you enter a destination in your Google Maps program or in your car, it gives you very precise driving directions, instructions on how to get there. But if you enter the wrong destination, you'll get very accurate driving directions to the wrong place. So let's imagine that, you know, we have a spiritual GPS and we enter our destination as success. Well, if I want to be successful, you know, I might have to compromise some things. I might have to use people in certain ways. I might have to be more manipulative. I might have to get more into office politics. I may have to make some trades about time with my family versus time at work, time with friends versus time at work. And I can make some tragic choices. The scripture says that those who have a love of money pierce themselves with many griefs. And so success can become an idol and an obsession in our lives. It can become the main thing we're living for, to be more successful, more and more successful. Now, on the other hand, if I enter into my spiritual GPS faithfulness, I want to be a faithful follower of Christ. And that's my focus. And that's my goal. I go to work now and I think, hey, I'm Christ's ambassador in this place. I'm here to minister to the people I'm surrounded with, my coworkers. I'm here to demonstrate the character of Christ, the love of Christ to the people around me. And I'm here to model the integrity and character of Jesus to those that I work with. So now it's not about whether I'm going to get ahead or get a promotion. It's like, how can I be a good ambassador for Christ? Now, I believe if you do that, you're likely to be more successful, not because success was your goal, but because those biblical principles often lead to success. They don't always lead to success. You could be a middle manager the rest of your life, and that's okay. But often these characteristics and these values lead to success.
You're listening in on my conversation with Rich Stearns. After spending more than 20 years as president of World Vision, he now has the title President Emeritus. His new book is Lead Like It Matters to God. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have more with Rich Stearns after this short break. Welcome back to the program. I'm Warren Smith, and you're listening in today on my conversation with Rich Stearns. Rich Stearns' previous books include 2010's The Hole in the Gospel, which made a number of best of lists that year. Today, we're discussing his latest book, Lead Like It Matters to God. Rich, I want to pivot in our conversation just a little bit and drill down into a couple of other of these concepts that I found to be pretty powerful. One of them is this idea of effort versus outcome, that you obviously favor one over the other. Talk a little bit more about the difference between the two and why one for the Christian should be more important than the other.
You know, just about every management system that I've been familiar with is outcome-driven, outcome-based. You know, it's all about the goal. For a corporation, it's, you know, earnings per share or return on shareholder value or, you know, any number of those metrics. For ministries, you know, World Vision, how many kids did we get sponsored? How much revenue have we got coming in? Are we managing our overhead the right way? We all had scorecards and goals and targets. And so there's nothing wrong with goals and targets, but we have to be really careful because what we really want to reward in the people who work with us or work for us is their effort. Because if you consistently make your best efforts, you're probably going to be successful. But there are many times when you make your best efforts, but you don't succeed. You don't meet the goal. And when you punish somebody because they didn't reach the goal, you're kind of punishing them for making their best effort, you know? And somebody else who didn't make their best effort might hit their goal, and you reward them. And now you're rewarding them for not making their best effort. And so you have to be really careful about the message you're sending. And so many compensation and bonus systems are based on outcomes and achievement. And I get that. But sometimes a team is successful, not because they've made such a good effort, but because they got lucky. You know, the business conditions were just perfect for them. And another team worked their heart out, but business conditions turned on them and they, you know, they didn't achieve the goal, even though they worked twice as hard as the first team. And so when you see that team getting punished and then the other team gets rewarded, it's really demotivating. So I talk in that chapter about excellence. You know, we want to be people of excellence, and excellence means giving your best for the Lord. You know, working with all your heart, mind, and strength, you know, at whatever you're doing. You know, if you're a tent maker like Paul, or if you're a corporate CEO, or whatever your job is, it reflects on Christ how much effort you put in. And if you're a person of excellence, over time, that is going to serve you well, because when you make your best efforts, you're going to be more successful in the long term at achieving those goals.
Another important idea in your book, and I'm going to kind of conflate a couple of different chapters and a couple of different ideas, Rich, is this idea of there's no such thing as a sacred or secular vocation, that if God has called you to it and you're doing that work to the best of your ability with all, you know, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and for His glory, it doesn't matter whether you're a janitor or a missionary. And related to that is this idea of calling itself, that if God has called us, it's because He loves us and He has a place for us, and there's an inherent dignity in the work, no matter what that work is. Again, you talk about these in different ways in different places in the book, but is that a fair representation? Am I representing what your ideas are there accurately?
Yes, I think so. And let me make a couple of distinctions here, though. The verse that I speak about throughout the book is 2 Corinthians 5:20, that says, "We are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God is making His appeal through us." I believe that verse applies to every follower of Christ. Every one of us has been appointed an ambassador of Jesus Christ in this world. And so if you're working at a supermarket, if you're a Uber driver, if you're a podcaster, if you're an author, a CEO, your first job is to be an ambassador for Jesus Christ. And what do ambassadors do? Ambassadors try to represent the character and the values of the one who sent them. So if you're the U.S. ambassador to Ireland, you're trying to represent the best of America, the best qualities of America, the priorities of America to the country of Ireland, where you're stationed. And so, first of all, every Christian is called to be an ambassador for Christ. And if you think about that as job one, you know, that's my real job wherever I am. You know, that's a good way to think about it. Now, in terms of our calling, calling is a more subtle kind of concept. You know, for example, when I came to World Vision in 1998 from the corporate world, it was a very dramatic calling from the Lord. It was almost like I heard the Lord's voice, and there was no other way to explain it except that God wanted me to make this change, and I didn't even fully understand it. But most people don't have that kind of profound, Damascus Road calling that I did. But I think we can assume that right now, wherever we are, that's where God has stationed us, right? He has stationed us in whatever employment we have right now, and that's where we're serving Christ. That's where we're to be His ambassador. Now, we need to continually be open to God's will in terms of redirecting us, because sometimes God wants to redirect. And again, in my case, I was 47 years old. I was at the pinnacle of my career. And the Lord said, I've got a different job for you and I need you to go. And that sometimes happens to people. We have to be open to the Lord's will. This is why I talk about surrendering your career, because again, you want Christ's ambitions for you, not your own ambitions for yourself. And so you have to be, you have to hold on to your career loosely in your hands so that if the Lord wants to redirect you, you're willing to do it. You know, you're willing to pick up your tent and move.
You know, Rich, one of the things that I enjoyed about your book were some of these little personal anecdotes, and I want to kind of do a quick lightning round of a couple of them before we kind of enlarge our conversation beyond the book and talk about some of the issues that are going on in evangelicalism generally. Can't cover everything in the book, so let's just stipulate for the record that everybody listening should just go read the book if they want to know everything that's in the book. But a couple of the anecdotes that I would like you to talk about. One was what you called the Clint test, the Clint test. It's an experience that happened to you. If I'm remembering right, it was the one right out of MBA school, right out of grad school, and where you were interviewing for your first job. Am I remembering that right?
Well, you're close. I had worked 2 years at Gillette, and I was interviewing another job, a new job at Parker Brothers Game. So I was 25 years old, and I was kind of discouraged in my job at Gillette, didn't really like what I was doing. I didn't really see a good future there for me. And so I applied for this job at Parker Brothers Games. And so I went for a round of interviews, and it was a great day. I mean, I met the three marketing directors. My job was going to be a marketing assistant for one of the three marketing directors. I met the three marketing directors. I met some of the vice presidents, and I even did a drive-by with the CEO. Randolph Parker Barton was his name. He was the last Parker family president of the company. And then I met all of the bigwigs, I guess you'd say. And then at lunch, they sent me out for 2 hours with a guy named Clint. And Clint was kind of a lower level marketing research analyst. And I thought, well, that's kind of funny. I mean, why would they send me out with this guy after meeting with all the vice presidents and the muckety mucks at Parker Brothers? So Clint and I had one to 2 hour lunch. I remember eating fried clams somewhere around Ipswich and had a great conversation. And I picked his brain about what was it like to work at Parker Brothers. And so anyways, a week later, I got the job. They made me the job offer. I was ecstatic. A week after that, or 2 weeks after that, I went in for my first day at work. And my new boss is part of the orientation. He said, well, you know why we hired you, don't you? And I said, and I'm thinking, well, I was a great interviewer. You know, it's my natural good looks. It's my you know, 20 months of work experience, you know, that I'd had at that point, age 25. And he said, no, you know, he said, we hired you because Clint said you were a good guy. You know, he said, we knew you'd be on your best behavior with the directors and the vice presidents. We wanted to see if you were a jerk. So we sent you out to lunch with somebody who would help you let your guard down and he'd be able to see what you were really like. Yeah. And Clint said you were a good guy, so we hired you.
Yeah. Well, you have a whole chapter in your book. In fact, this may be where that story is about character and integrity. You have one chapter on integrity and then you have another chapter on character. And, but you know, character is who you are when no one is watching, I believe is the definition, one of the definitions that you used. And in a way, I guess that was an example of that, right? I mean, whenever you didn't have anybody to impress, they wanted to see what kind of a person you really are. And again, it took me kind of back to this idea of, you know, who are we really? What is our character? And just how important that is. Not only was it tactically important for you in that moment in your life and career, but it really is important for us as leaders, no matter what stage in life we are.
Well, and I'm a big believer in, you know, we need to be people who, what you see is what you get, you know, that we're not three different people depending on the setting we're in. You know, we are an authentic person, people of integrity, wherever we are. So we want to have the same character at work that we have at home, that we have at church, that we have out in the community if we're coaching Little League or something like that. And we don't want to live a lie. I mean, people that start living fabricated lives where they're posing as something at work and they're posing as something else socially, they start to get really tangled up in their lives. They get caught in their deceptions and in their lies. And it's so much easier. You can sleep so much more soundly. The book of Proverbs talks about this. If you just kind of lead an honest life where what you see is what you get, and people trust you because you're authentic.
Right. A mentor of mine once said, always tell the truth and you don't have to have a good memory. You don't have to remember what you said. And I think there's a certain, a lot to be said for just living authentically, living who you are, and you don't, it takes a lot of stress out of your life. At least I've discovered as I've gotten older that it has for me, at least. I'm not sure that maybe sometimes I need a few filters. But anyway, Rich, one more quick story before, again, we kind of enlarge our conversation. And that is, you talk a lot about love. You talk about a lot about forgiveness. You talk a lot about humility in this book, which, again, are not necessarily qualities that you would read in a secular leadership book, but because you're pursuing a biblical model, you do. And one of the stories that you tell that helps get at some of this is a story about Syria and Lebanon, and you visiting a church there. Can you recount that story briefly?
Yeah, I think it's on the chapter for forgiveness, because in the chapter on forgiveness, I say that, a good leader is always willing to forgive someone who makes a mistake, and is also willing to ask for forgiveness when they've done something that maybe hurt someone else. And so, and I talk about, how do you love your particularly unlovable coworker? Because, most workplaces have a few of those that, people that are very hard to love or like in the workplace. And I said, so I told a story of forgiveness from Syria. And, I flew over to Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan several times during the Syrian refugee crisis, which is still ongoing. And I met with the churches in Lebanon in particular. And the story goes that Lebanon was actually occupied by Syria from, I think, 1976 to 2006, so about 30 years. And they were literally under military occupation by Syria. Syrians killed their prime minister, raped their women, trashed their economy. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible situation during the civil war over there in Lebanon. And then the Syrians pulled out. I think it was 2006. They pulled out and Lebanon kind of got back on its feet. And just 5 years later, there's a civil war now in Syria, And literally millions of Syrian people are fleeing into Lebanon, asking for help. Now, most people would think this is time to get even, right? It's like, after what you did to us for 30 years, and now you have the nerve to come into our country and beg for help, and so I talked to these Christian churches over there on the front lines, and they were actually welcoming Syrian refugees, almost all of whom were Muslim. And they were feeding them. They were, helping them build tent camps. They were inviting them into their churches. They were being advocates for them. And I remember asking the pastor, several of the pastors, how can you do this? How can you find it in your heart to forgive these people? And I'll paraphrase it because I don't have the book in front of me, but I have the exact quote in my book. But it basically said, we need to love these people. We need to show them the love of God. They were really enemies. These were not just people we didn't like. They were enemies of our people. But, love is healing. Love overcomes. Love can turn an enemy into a friend. And, we need to show them the love of Christ. That was the essence of his message. And that next Sunday, I attended one of the church services. It was an outdoor service. And I stood there with tears in my eyes because I saw dozens and dozens of Muslim families walking into the church service with their children and listening to a sermon about the Lord and hearing the gospel and responding to the love that they had been shown by these Lebanese Christians. Powerful.
You're listening in on my conversation with Rich Stearns. We're discussing his new book, Lead Like It Matters to God. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have a few final thoughts with Rich Stearns after this short break. Welcome back. You're listening in on my interview with Rich Stearns. Let's get right back to that conversation. Rich, I'd like to pivot one more time in our conversation, and if you'll allow me to kind of leave the book behind, even though, you know, maybe we'll circle back around to it a bit. But I want to talk to you about leadership in the larger context of the evangelical culture right now, because I think a lot of folks would agree with me when I say that I think we have a real crisis in leadership right now. You know, my current day job, whenever I'm not interviewing people like you for Listening In, is to I'm the president of Ministry Watch, and I've been writing a lot about leaders who did not finish well. Ravi Zacharias, Bill Hybels, the list could go on and on and on, and I won't itemize each one of them here, but they ran into problems along the way. They ran into problems with character. They ran into problems with integrity. They ran into problems with humility, of thinking they were maybe bigger than their britches and the rules didn't apply to them anymore. I guess I'm trying to get around to a question here, but I kind of want to know what you think about all of this. I mean, are we in a crisis mode in evangelicalism, or is this a "this too shall pass" moment?
You know, Warren, one of the reasons I wrote this book, and the book covers 17 key leadership qualities, and you've mentioned a number of them: love, integrity, forgiveness, humility, et cetera, excellence. And I wrote it because I felt we are in a crisis of leadership in this country, yes, within the church and within ministries, but also in the broader culture. We've seen corporate scandals. We've seen the Me Too movement, where so much sexual harassment in every workplace has been revealed. We've seen sports cheating scandals. We've seen the opioid scandal, where corporations put profit ahead of people and things that were killing their own customers. But, you know, let's sell more and more opioids and keep pushing them. And in our politics, we've seen scandals, and we've seen, politicians from both parties that lack character, that lack basic integrity, and the things that I write about in this book. And then, yes, sadly, within the church and within ministries, we've seen many, many, too many scandals. I think at the root of it, and I've known some of these leaders as well, but I think at the root of it, I say in the book, the worst thing a leader can do is to start believing their own press clippings. You know, leadership comes with power, and power starts to go to our heads. And so I think it's urgent or essential for every leader to stay grounded, to remember that they put on their pants one leg at a time, just like everybody else, that, you know, God put them in that leadership position and God can take them out as well. And for me, the things that helped me is I always believed in surrounding myself with really strong people who were on my senior teams, and then giving them permission to criticize me, disagree with me, hold me accountable. I wanted people that would tell the emperor when he had no clothes. And I had a board that did that well when I was at World Vision. I had a board that, you know, really looked to that and did their responsibility well. When they did my performance review every year, they even talked to my wife as part of the performance review. And they talked to each of the people that reported to me to make sure that I had my feet on the ground and I was okay. And I think when you start believing your own press clippings and you start to feel, you know, like you can do anything, you know, you're bigger and better than everybody else. You're the best preacher in the world. You're the, you know, look at the size of your church or your ministry. You know, those are just danger signals, you know, riding in limousines, flying in private jets. I flew coach for 20 years at World Vision. Only a few times when I got upgrades did I fly business class or something like that. But I just felt it was important, you know, to be grounded and not treat myself like I was royalty. After all, I was serving the poor, you know, and it just didn't seem right for me to be, you know, living like a king while serving the poor. So I just think humility is the most important quality there. And to keep yourself humble, you have to surround yourself with people that will, and give them permission, because I've seen some of these leaders, they're surrounded by sycophants who are so in awe of the leader's abilities that they're just yes men and yes women. They just they fawn over every word the leader says, and that goes to a person's head. You know, that really goes to a person's head.
Well, I completely agree with that, and I appreciate those good words. I do want you to react to this idea, though, and just tell me what you think based on, you know, what you've seen over the years. I agree with you that believing your own press clippings is a big problem, and that I just don't think human beings are kind of wired for the kind of to respond well to the kind of adoration that really should be reserved for God himself. Another thing that I'm coming slowly to believe, and I just want to test this theory out with you, is that, you know, while I'm not opposed inherently, there's nothing in the Bible that says big is bad and small is good. I do believe that it is very, very difficult for any leader or even a group of leaders to know fully what's going on in an organization once it gets big, that the amount of money that's involved there, the amount of controls that are necessary, it just becomes tough. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it has seemed to me that in my lifetime, Rich, I've seen a lot of Christian organizations get really big. I've seen the Christian marketplace for books and music and movies and everything else get really big. I'm often referred to that as the evangelical industrial complex or the Christian industrial complex. But, you know, I would also have to say that, you know, no one exemplifies that more, if you're just going to look at size, than World Vision itself. You know, under your leadership, World Vision got really, really big. It you know, doubled, tripled in size. How did you fight against those tendencies to become bureaucratic in a way that would prevent you from really knowing what was going on in the culture of that organization?
Well, it's a constant struggle to keep any organization, and the bigger the organization, the harder to keep any organization faithful to, you know, these core biblical values. And, you know, it's a full-time job. You have to constantly be setting the tone of expectations and the values you expect this organization to abide by, values of integrity and transparency and doing the right thing and trying to live modestly in terms of expenses and travel and those kinds of things. And so, you know, we used to talk about the tone at the top, you know, that people will take their cues from the people in senior leadership positions. And so we really tried in my team at World Vision to, you know, show the organization what this looks like when you practice it in terms of, you know, our lifestyles and our commitment to integrity and as an organization. So, you know, leaders set the tone. Leaders create the value systems within which organizations operate. And if a leader lets the organization know that integrity is absolutely inviolable, and if there's a lack of integrity is found in you or your department, you're done. You're done at this organization. It's kind of a zero tolerance policy for certain things, you know? And so I believe it's possible to have a very large organization that lives by those principles. But you're also true, right, in saying that you can't always know. I mean, World Vision had 44,000 employees in 100 countries. And we had our share of, you know, financial mismanagement issues in Chad and, you know, certain countries where the controls weren't good enough. But again, when you discover that, then you have to deal with it decisively. And sometimes we would even turn our own employee over to the authorities, you know, because they broke the law. And then we would send a message to everybody else in that country office that this is what happens when you do something untoward financially with donor money, and there's accountability and there are consequences. And so, again, you're constantly trying to make sure, you know, there's no weeds in your lawn, right? You know, you're pulling right. all the weeds as soon as you find them.
Well, speaking of weeds, let me ask you this. Any decisions or any episodes when you were at World Vision that you regret, that you said, boy, I sure wish I'd handled that differently?
You know, I mean, there are probably many that I wish I'd handled differently. And there's not one that comes to mind right now, Warren. But, you know, leaders are going to make mistakes. And I say that in the book. You know, it's not, you know, being a good leader doesn't mean you never make a mistake. But it means that when you make a mistake, you kind of own it. You own up to it. You apologize. If your mistake has hurt other people, you apologize and you ask for forgiveness. And what I found is that people are willing to forgive if you come to them with a sincere apology and you say, hey, I really messed this up and I should have listened to you if it's maybe somebody on your team. But that's how you kind of live from mistake to mistake, because you know, and I think of King David in the mistake he made with Bathsheba and killing her husband. And it was just a horrible episode. I mean, you can't think of a worse leadership mistake than King David made. And yet he was truly repentant after he was confronted with that by Nathan. And he begged the Lord for forgiveness. You know, he did everything he could to try to atone for his own sin and own his sin as well. And so David, even today, is known as a great leader after God's own heart, not because he was perfect, but because he would learn from those mistakes and own them and prostrate himself before the Lord, begging for forgiveness.
Rich, our time is drawing to a close here, but I have two quick questions I want to ask you kind of in closing here. One is just if you could say a little bit more about something that we talked about before I turned the recorder on, and that is that at World Vision, now that you're retired and approaching the age of 70, you told me a few moments ago, you have kind of an elders council that you meet with periodically. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, so one of the terrible things when you retire from World Vision, and I spent 20 years there, is I had so many wonderful colleagues from all over the world. I mean, talk about the diversity of God's kingdom, but friends from Indonesia and India and Africa and Australia and Canada and, you know, just all over the world. And, you know, one day you're shoulder to shoulder with these colleagues, you know, going to global meetings, tackling really difficult problems like the Syrian refugee crisis, and you're putting your heads together, you're praying about it together, and then all of a sudden you're all retired. You know, it's all like I said to you, it's like you're going down a conveyor belt and you all fall off the end of the conveyor belt at the end, and it's done. And now there are new leaders at World Vision, and there's great leaders at World Vision, but we have moved on, this group of elders. And so the first year I was retired, I just really missed the fellowship that I had had. You know, there's a group of people that very few people would really understand what World Vision was like, except this group of colleagues who had similar responsibilities to my own. And so one of them said, hey, let's do a Zoom call and let's catch up. And we ultimately, there's about 10 or 12 of us now that are invited to a Zoom call once a month. And, you know, 12 don't show up every time. It's usually 8 or so. You know, it might be 5 in the morning in Tanzania and 12 in the afternoon in Australia and 7 at night in Seattle. So we try to get on the call, but these are those colleagues, all of whom are retired from World Vision, who I valued so much. And we share about each other's lives. We pray for each other's families. And then we finish by praying for the ministry of World Vision, that God would protect it around the world and God would protect the workers and the staff. And so it's been really a wonderful way to stay connected to important colleagues.
Yeah, it really does sound like a wonderful practice that you have developed there. Rich, and now my final question closing. Whenever I get a chance to talk to somebody like you who've had a kind of a long and successful career and, you know, measured by both... in both ways that we were talking about measuring success, not only with kind of the metrics, but also with faithfulness, and you've reached, you know, kind of a retirement age there. I guess I'd just like to ask, what do you want your legacy to be? What do you want people to say about Rich Stearns when he's gone?
You know, I've often said to my wife that The only thing I'd like on my tombstone is the phrase, he was faithful. He was faithful. Faithful to his wife, faithful to his family, faithful to his responsibilities, faithful to the Lord. You know, most of what I accomplished in my career was God working through me, and to him goes the credit and the glory. I never believed I could lead World Vision. I didn't think I had the background for it. I was terrified coming into that job. And I just told the Lord on the first day, I said, Lord, I can't do this. I don't know what to do. And I'm going to really mess this ministry up unless you take over. And I remember I felt like the Lord said to me, I've got you right where I want you, helpless and completely dependent on me. Now just watch what I do. Watch what I do. And I think that's what I did. I watched what the Lord did over 20 years in tackling the AIDS pandemic and bringing clean water to 3 or 4 million people a year. Just all the amazing things that happened during those 20 years. But it was God's grace. And I think God's lifting up of that organization and just using me. I mean, we're vessels. We're vessels to be used by the Lord. And that's hopefully what he did with me.
Well, Rich Stearns, thank you so much for being on the program today. It's been a real pleasure to visit with you and also to kind of talk about some of the ideas in your book, which I found to be very nourishing. So thanks again.
Hey, thanks, Warren. It was great.
That brings to a close my conversation with Rich Stearns. His new book is Lead Like It Matters to God, Values-Driven Leadership in a Success-Driven World. A couple of quick notes before we go. First, I'd like to thank the more than 900 of you who've rated listening in on the podcast app. I read every comment, and the more ratings we get, the easier it is for search engines to find us. So if you haven't rated the program, I hope you will consider doing so. It's an easy way to support the program that doesn't cost you a dime. Secondly, I hope you'll check out the Listening In archives. We're now in our 8th year of doing these in-depth interviews, like the one you just heard. And that means that we've got more than 400 interviews with musicians, filmmakers, politicians, writers, culture shapers, thought leaders, and newsmakers. With so large an archive, there's a good chance someone you're interested in is there. The best way to find out is to simply go to the World News Group website, WNG.org, and type the name of the person or topic that you'd like to know more about into the search engine. Something good will very likely pop up. Listening In comes to you from World News Group. Your membership in World helps to support this program as well as World's other digital and print content. To find out more about becoming a member of World, you can go to getworldnow.com. The producer for today's program is Johnny Franklin, and he gets technical support from Carl Peets and Kristen Flavin. Our executive producer is Nick Eicher. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.